From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's always fun to have old friends come back to the show. And there's no better old friend than our old friend Adam McKay, who's hot off a new film. Of course, the film is Vice. So good to have you back here. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Always good to have you. And one of my favorite films of yours happens to be The Other Guys, which in some ways, there is a line we can look at the films that you've done, so many of them about guys who live in their own head, and their version of the world is different than the world, anybody else's perception of the world. And sometimes through sheer will, they can make it happen, but often they're failing. Chaney is the guy who actually made it happen.
Oh, my God, that's an interesting comparison. I like that. The character, Will's character from The Other Guys compared to Dick Cheney. But you're right. You're right. Cheney is a guy who definitely keeps his cards close to his chest, as a lot of the time is spent in his head. And boy, oh, boy, did he change the course of history. There's no question.
But often these guys have failed in some ways spectacularly, and you start off with Cheney's failure here. And it's this interesting through line for me, these people who are so in their own world that sometimes they can't get out of their own way, but Cheney is the one who actually found a way to sort of bend the world to his will.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is about his wife. I think a lot of it's about Lynn Cheney. We did our own research, and we went back to his hometown in Casper, Wyoming, and people to this day say no matter who Lynn would have married, they would have become president or vice president. And if you look at like Dick Cheney's brother and sister, they're pretty normal people. And his mom and dad were Democrats, FDR Democrats. And it seems to me like I think Dick Cheney probably would have been a lineman, would have like taken local community college classes, maybe become a manager of like a line team, you know, for the state. But he saw the prettiest girl in the state, Lynn Vincent, and after some pretty hard stumbles in the beginning, you're right. I mean, he had a bunch of DUIs. He got thrown out of Yale. He finally white-knuckled it and pulled himself together and became quite a force.
And like some of these other guys you've written in, be it in Step Brothers or Talladega Nights or Anchorman, these guys often have a problem with anger.
Yeah.
And he's the guy who wrestled this anger and turned into this other – and turned it into ambition.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, Christian had an interpretation at one point that was, you know, Cheney has that kind of locked jaw. The side of his mouth is kind of clenched all the time.
Right.
And Christian's interpretation was that's where the anger went. That's where the cavorting in the bars, you know, drinking, all that kind of stuff went into that locked jaw. And I thought it was really interesting. And if you notice in the performance, as it continues through the movie, it gets more pronounced. All those kind of, I mean, that is kind of what we do. That's how we hold things in those kinds of gestures or those sort of physical habits.
And it even sort of appends to the way he uses his arm on that side. I mean, that arm becomes a thing he uses more than any other part of his body.
It's true.
I mean, yeah. He's basically sort of stationary except for that arm and that jaw flexing all the time.
Fascinating. Yeah. That's how deep Bale goes. He gets into every little gesture.
But he was that physical for you on The Big Short, too, was he not?
Yeah, that was another, interestingly enough, that was Michael Burry he was playing. And that was another guy who was in his head. And we actually got to meet the real guy. He's a lovely guy. And what attracted Christian to that character was the fact that it was a character who was in his head. He and I talked about it. Like, isn't that the ultimate thing if you can act and bring out someone's interior life? And a lot of Michael Burry is interior. And I think that was the same attraction for him with Dick Cheney. We certainly talked about it quite a bit. This is another guy who doesn't want to be in the spotlight, who doesn't really want his story told in any grand way. I mean, if you read Dick Cheney's autobiography, it reads like a court deposition.
I was going to say, it's the most dispassionate. It's almost reportorial about his own life.
Yeah, yeah. He skips over everything. Everything just feels like it's bullet points. And you almost get the sense at the end, he almost wanted to say, like, there, I did it. Now leave me alone. Like,
it's his autobiography, his PowerPoint presentation. But again, that's why I wanted to talk a little bit about Big Short, just because in a lot of ways, those guys are similar too. I mean, a lot of physical anger. They're trying to find other ways to sublimate. And this idea of guys not knowing what to do with anger or wrestling with anger constantly is something that is kind of a wellspring for you as a writer.
I mean, you think about the world we live in right now. It's kind of interesting. Like, what do you do with the information that we're getting right now? I mean, you look at the news any day. It's so bizarre and upside down and upsetting. And yet it does no good to be ranting and raving on the streets. I think there's fear. I think there's anger. I think there's a lot of feelings flying around the world right now. And especially for, you know, some of these men characters, as the world changes, where do you put your anger? How do you deal with these kind of feelings in a more modern world, especially when the modern world is so complicated and playing such a game? I mean, you look at The Big Short, that game is so heady and devious that the big banks played on us. And especially Carell's character is just furious throughout the entire movie. And everyone around him is basically saying, calm down, yet he's right. I mean, that's the worst. It's one thing to be mad and you're wrong. But when you're mad and you're right, then it really gets interesting.
But I just find that it's, again, for me, even looking at a bunch of the sketch show of you, or your shorts, anger so often plays a part and how anger is directed. And I wondered when it seemed to occur to you that anger was a kind of a wellspring for both, for material for you.
Anger is, it's fascinating, like being in the modern world. I had a doctor tell me a long time ago, I was like grinding my teeth or something.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, for 100,000 years, when human beings were angry, they would bite someone. We actually have an incredibly strong bite. And that was a move we went to. You know, you forget. We were like kind of, you know.
Animals.
Yeah, we were animals. And you look at one of my favorite movies, Altered States, one of my all-time favorite movies, like we would bite people. And this question, and then you look at democracy, representative democracy is what, 275 years old, something like that? We're still trying to figure this out, clearly. It's no accident that in Vice, you'll occasionally see animals pop up. There's like a hyena in the movie. There's a tiger. And I've always talked about like where our current governmental system is. Politics in our country has almost just become a bunch of hyenas fighting over a, you know, a kickbox shank in the savannas. I mean, I think we like to ignore the animal part of us, you know. And so I love that you're pointing that out. It's definitely part of it. There's no question.
It really is that, though. By the way, it's the only guest on the show who's ever brought up a Patty Chayefsky, Ken Russell collaboration is sitting across from me. Adam McKay's new film, of course, is Vice. But so much of this for you, turning to Chaney, and I know you talked about this before, but I want to get into it a little bit here. It's just about this idea of people trying to look back at the Bush era in the nostalgic ways and sort of thinking it's better than where we are now. And in fact, not only is it not, but it really laid the groundwork for where we are now.
Yeah, that was a weird moment. I don't know if you remember when that first started happening, when people were like, kind of makes you miss Bush. And I was like, what are you talking about? And then like Bush is on Ellen DeGeneres' show dancing with her. And was it like Michelle Obama was like hugging him like a puppy at one point? He's a weird character.
It's that line from Chinatown. Was it whores, ugly buildings, and bankers all become respectable? They last long enough?
Oh, that's a good line.
But there's been a shift in the movie, starting with, I think, with The Other Guys, but also in Succession, and certainly in Big Short, and here too, you're actually using information as a way to tell the story, mm-hmm. which is, for me, the biggest shift in the way that you are using comedy now is you're using real-world facts as a way to buttress how absurd these situations are.
Yeah, I think at a certain point, it's especially when you're trying to tell a history of the Republican Revolution, you know, from the late 70s till now, you need some facts. You need to know, like, hey, they started these right-wing think tanks. Roger Ailes was in the Nixon White House. This isn't made up.
He was a producer on the Mike Douglas show, for
exactly,
God's sakes.
Exactly, exactly. Mike Douglas almost became president. No, I'm making that up.
it couldn't be worse.
So audiences are so sophisticated now. They're so used to watching all kinds of different movies and television and YouTube videos and conspiracy videos, like, they seem to be able to handle it. I mean, I notice even
when... Do they seem to be able to handle it? Or is it, for me, it gets back to the idea that information don't. They just feel like they have all this stuff to really support what it is they're thinking rather than looking for information that opens them up.
I mean, I would hope anyone watching the movie Vice or The Big Short would then go, huh, let's see if this is for real and look up a couple of the facts. I mean, we obviously fact check the heck out of the movie, so it's accurate. But I mean, that's how I remember encountering stuff like that, is you would read it and you'd get really excited. I mean, do you remember the movie After Hours, Scorsese movie?
Yeah, sure.
So there were all these literary quotes that were littering the movie, that were kind of buried in the movie. And I just went and started looking them up. I mean, he starts by reading Henry Miller. There's a whole Franz Kafka section. Yeah. And I was 18 when that movie came out, and it was really cool. It turned me on to all these different writers I wouldn't have read. So I think, you know, God forbid anyone ever look at a movie as the definitive statement on anything. It's a part of the discussion.
But people do, though. I mean, the movies that are taken now is part of history.
Part of history. I think it should be a part of the discussion. But my dream would be that, you know, you watch Vice and you go, okay, what's this numbskull trying to tell me? Let's go read Barton Gellman's Angler. Let's go read The 1% Doctrine by Ron Suskind. Let's go read some great interviews out there. There's a bunch of them. Vanity Fair's done some great profiles on Cheney. Let's read the great Jane Mayer, The Dark Side. There's some great documentaries you can watch. I would hope it would lead to some of that at least.
Do you find this the case? Because I think I asked you once, have you found that after, during the end credits of The Other Guys, that people found themselves struck in a way that they hadn't before? And if they, in fact, did engage and go out and try to seek out other information, because you lay out a comedy about an economic conspiracy theory, but then you bring facts to bear that show this kind of thing does and is happening.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's funny it with all movies, and it's probably the same thing for you, and it's probably the same thing for viewers and filmmakers. I guess you just do what you like, and I would like that. I would like going to a movie, and I'm watching a character piece, and I'm watching one of the greatest, two of the greatest actors in Christian Bale and Amy Adams just, you know, do these amazing scenes, and then there's almost like a little side snack that is like, oh, by the way, late 70s is when Richard Mellon-Scaife and the Coors and the Cokes came to D.C. and opened right-wing think tanks. Like, oh, I didn't know that. And then you move back into your character work. So I like the blend. I like the idea that you can mix information with character work, with scenic work, with beautiful footage. It's a different kind of salad. You know, you're definitely putting cut grapes into the salad at that point. It's becoming something else. And that's the worst analogy I think I've ever made in my entire life. And I want to apologize.
Well, it's on record now.
But shoot.
but I think what's so interesting about these cases, too, is that as these movies are both digressive as well as discursive, this is the way these characters are. They live so much in their head that, in fact, they feel like they're like telling the story of the world. We talked before about 24-Hour Party People, which, of course, isn't that same kind of film where he steps out and tells us what's happening because things are happening around us, as things are happening around us in the movie. And these characters live almost in that same kind of way, it feels to me, that their heads are kind of constantly having these kinds of digressions. You found a way to incorporate that sort of bisected consciousness into the filmmaking.
Well, I think you're spot on. They're constantly trying to frame and spin their own lives while they're living them. And they're constantly trying to position themselves in the right position. And to actually have them do that nakedly in the movie feels oddly honest in a way. There's another movie we were influenced by, an Italian movie called Il Divo.
Oh, golly, sure.
Yeah, love that movie. It's about a super corrupt actual prime minister of Italy who serves 7 terms. And it's incredibly stylized. A lot of like overcrank slow motion, stop frame.
No, it's breaking narrative all the time.
Yeah, and it's very similar because the way
but it's more surreal though than what you're doing in Vice.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's definitely not the same tone, but I love that filmmaker gave himself permission to say, "Hey, this is an old corrupt prime minister kind of running games out of all these offices. Let's play it like a gangster movie." And that was an exciting movie when I saw that because, you know, you go back and you look at Goodfellas, you look at these movies, and we're looking at gangsters, but these are the guys who are really doing it. I mean, they estimate there's $23 trillion in money in offshore bank accounts right now worldwide. $23 trillion. I mean, it makes gangsters look adorable when you start getting into that realm. So yeah, messing with style, breaking the fourth wall, being self, having the characters be self-conscious, be naked about what they're doing. You know, I think part of what we're also just trying to do is the world is, you know, in a very strange place right now. And we're just trying to find new ways to tell stories, new ways to communicate that acknowledge that.
We'll take a break. My guest who's giving us way too much information is Adam McKay. His new film is writer director. is Vice. If you got all that $23 billion, give some of that to public radio. We'll take a break. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. There's too much information. Nobody's ever said that about this show before. It's the treatment. My guest is our old friend Adam McKay. Of course, his new film is Vice. But I have to ask you about one particular scene, the scene where Cheney sits down with Bush, and it's almost like watching a director seduce an actor into doing something. And I wonder, because that really felt to me like almost a microcosm sort of satire of show business in some way.
A lot of that's word for word too.
Yeah, I know, but the way it's played though is it's really interesting. It's because also I was reminded of Chinatown, of Gittes going to Catalina and sitting down across. I mean, and just sort of seeing where real power is, and how sort of fluid that line is.
I love the dynamic between Bale's performance as Cheney and Rockwell's as Bush, because you really can feel with Cheney all the years of his growth when he walks into those meetings with Bush. Depending on your political point of view, he's either a Jedi or a Sith Lord. But either way, there's a lot of power walking into the room when he comes in. And you really
I don't think anybody thinks he's a Jedi. Well, okay. I hope nobody who's going to see the movie thinks he's a Jedi.
He had a 13% approval rating when he left office. So to that 13%, I'll say it. But you could feel the power when he walks in, and the experience and the knowledge. And by all accounts, you know, W. Bush was so green. Like, people forget.
He had failed running a baseball team. He had failed in the oil business. He had failed just about everything he sort of put his mind to.
He had a 12-year gap in his employment history. 12 years on his resume with nothing.
He didn't have a passport when he was running for president.
Is that true?
Yes.
Oh, my God. His first job out of college, he was selling tropical plants. So it's amazing. I mean, it really is. It's astounding. It's jaw-dropping. And I agree with you. That scene where Bush is eating the chicken and Cheney flatters him. I can tell you're the kind of man who operates, I can't remember what he says, instinctively. Not like your father in that regard. And you just, Sam plays it so perfectly. He just laps it up. And people have said that about me. Those two scenes, man, and watching, you forget Sam Rockwell too is one of the great actors striding the globe at this moment.
And so, it would have been easy to nudge that into parody.
Oh, yeah.
And rather than have it, that's what I'm saying. To me, it felt like that scene in Chinatown where you're seeing where the real power is.
Yeah.
And so much was not. It's a way something is said rather than what's being said.
Yeah, yeah. The silences. And the first scene, too, when he comes into the governor's office, he comes into Bush's office, there's a lot of nice pauses in those scenes where you can see Cheney just checking him out and analyzing him, like the angler standing on the bend of the river looking at the ripples of the water and what mosquitoes the fish are feeding on, just that eye of detail that everyone said that Cheney had.
I find it interesting, too, because also – you deal with a lot of situations where guys want power. I mean, and they think they have it until they lose it. And that even happens with Cheney when he's part of the Nixon administration, when he thinks he has power until that goes away.
Yeah.
And he realizes he's only in the corridors of power and not there. And so many of these characters that you've written are these guys who are sort of grasping at this thing and can't get their arms around it.
Yeah, the guys in The Big Short have the power of knowledge, but no one will acknowledge the power. and it's driving them crazy. And then you're right. In Vice, another movie I always looked at was Sid and Nancy by Alex Cox.
Sure.
Yeah, love story kind of that's wrapped with addiction.
And about anger as well.
And about anger as well, for sure. I always looked at that. Yeah, I mean, it's especially when you talk about the changes that have been happening in the last 10 or 20 years as far as, you know, our country, the way people interrelate. You talk about men, the way men relate to power. It's changing very fast. It's an interesting dynamic, and especially to see men that are comfortable with a certain degree of power, that think they understand it, and then the world is turning upside down and becoming a living cartoon. How do you relate to that, you know, when you're being told that in 11 years, you know, we're going to go into an extinction level event with global warming? Suddenly you're supposed to feel good that you're, you know, a manager of a camera shop.
Well, like, take it bigger. If you're a white guy in power, you're told that in 15 years that you won't be the predominant population in the country anymore. I mean, so that there's that too, isn't there?
There's that too. There's no question. Oh, no. White men are, you know, we know they're freaking out. Like there's a bunch of them freaking out. And and sometimes I'll read too on social media, you'll see these white men freaking out and they sound like Will Ferrell characters. I mean, they sound like Ron Burgundy and Anchorman. Women have a brain half the size of men. It's science, you know.
My guest who's bringing way too much science to this conversation is, of course, Adam McKay. His new film is Vice. Of course, I have to talk to you about a minor obsession we both have. And I let you know after I saw the movie, when the Galactus reference in the film, I almost jumped out of my chair. That was pretty thrilling. And by the way, exactly who Dick Cheney's, I don't know who that makes the Silver Surfer, but that I thought that was a pretty apt comparison. And I just wonder when that hit you.
I like who would the Silver Surfer be? That's Scooter Libby. That's Scooter Libby is the he's Norrin Rad.
So he's stuck on Earth.
We tried a bunch of different powerful, iconic images. We tried Godzilla. We tried a bunch of different ones.
Did you?
Yeah, we tried like Jason Voorhees. We just tried all these different iconic power images, and I kept coming back to Galactus, and it just worked for some reason. It just really fit. And God bless Kevin Feige and God bless Marvel. They let us use it because, you know, they don't treat that stuff lightly. That's, you know, that IP and Kevin Feige, you know, I was lucky enough to get to work on Ant-Man, to co-write Ant-Man. And he did.
Did you throw the Garrett Morris reference in there? Was that you?
That was not me. I wish it had been me. That would have been good. Who did put that in there? It's a good question.
I don't know.
But so fortunately, Feige allowed us to do it. But yeah, I think most people, when they're going to see a movie about Dick Cheney, they know Galactus is going to show up at some point. You have to put that in there.
But I guess I'm going back to this idea of these guys who are in effect infantile. And in somebody like Dick Cheney, he's one of these guys you've written who chose to make a conscious decision to be an adult. But you can see him wrestling with it throughout the movie. But was that the turn that really sort of showed you knew where to go with this? Because that's the thing that makes him different from anybody else you've written.
I mean, what was interesting was I heard a story, and it's kind of an off-the-record story, but I think it's harmless. I can tell it.
Sure.
Someone I know knew someone, it's a credible source, who knew someone who was one of his Secret Service guys during his years as VP. And pretty boring job. It's the vice president. Cheney wasn't getting threats. So it was around 2 in the morning, and he's walking around the vice president, the Naval Observatory, I think is where the vice president lives. And he hears a crackle in his ear, and it says there's a light on in the house. Around 2 in the morning, they should be asleep. And the guy, the Secret Service guy, walks over, and he looks in the window, and he sees in the living room Dick Cheney is seated there with a big plate in his lap with a giant sandwich, and he's watching The Godfather. Now, fair enough. We've all woken up in the middle of the night and made a sandwich. What I loved about it was he then says – this proceeds to happen 5-6 more times over the next 4 months, and it's always The Godfather. And for a second, we were going to put it in the movie.
I was going to say that big, was
but that it's something? So ridiculous. And I remember saying
as compared to some of the other breaks you have in the movie.
But I remember saying to the people on the movie exactly what you just said, which is you forget these guys are big kids. Like, you're watching The Godfather at 2 in the morning, 5-6 times. I mean, it's a great movie, don't get me wrong, but you're the vice president. Like, they're big kids. They really are, a lot of them.
But, I mean, that idea of these people who have never really grown up, and I just think that you've found a way to show the absurdity of that in these bigger, broad comedies, and now by taking real-life situations. Was that a conscious move for you to do that? Is it just something that happened kind of instinctively for you?
I think it was instinctive. I think a lot of it, I got to give credit to the book The Big Short, because that was the book I read and I couldn't put down in one night. I read the whole book in one night. And there was something in it and the way Lewis writes where he was calling stuff out and talking about how hard it was.
And it's a constant stream of information in that book too.
It's very dense with information and yet very lively, great characters, page turner, despite all that information. And that book just clicked with me in such a huge way. And that whole experience of making that movie, to find out that the times we live in have become strange enough that you could do a movie like The Big Short where you cut to an actress in a bathtub explaining how high finance works, or Anthony Bourdain, you know, comparing CDOs to a seafood stew, was a really exciting moment. And then even in talking to Lewis and talking to Charles Randolph, who co-authored the adaptation with me, just to see how neatly it fit, this kind of comic approach of breaking the routine, absurdity, you know, people's egos under attack and them not behaving well. All of that stuff fits so neatly with the world that we currently live in. It was surprising, but I definitely didn't have a conscious decision to look for it. It definitely was something that just fit.
And part of it, too, is just that what comedy has become and that wave of people coming out of Chicago, that idea is just sort of saying that the absurd exists with the normal. I mean, that thing, your famous bit of playing Noam Chomsky as a substitute, as a teacher. I mean, this, all these ideas, just sort of taking the real and placing it into the real world, just so we get these two absurd conflicts pushing up against each other.
And then you see the president of the United States in the White House presenting the biggest buffet of McDonald's hamburgers you could ever imagine. You've seen that photo of Trump?
Do you see that there's a piece of footage where one of the players going up to the buffet going, I thought this was a joke.
Wow. And that happened. Like, if we had put that in a movie, that would have been so ridiculous. I promise you, if we had put that in one of our movies, it would have been like, we got to cut that out of there. That's too crazy. Well, yeah, my other favorite is when he said we got to start sweeping the forests, raking the forests, and that's how you get rid of forest fires. And I remember just you could see Jerry Brown and Gavin Newsom with their heads down, and you just knew both of them wanted to go, holy God, out loud, but they didn't do it. What do you do when that's the reality? I mean, that is so much more absurd than anything we could imagine. I mean, the cheeseburgers in the White House, that's even in Idiocracy, like, that's directly from Idiocracy. It's I never thought I would live to see where the world is now. It's truly jaw-dropping and horrifying and funny and amazing and horrifying.
And so is your movie. I can't thank you enough. You're always welcome here anytime you want to come, Adam. Please come back.
Thank you, Elvis.
My guest is Adam McKay. He just blew our minds by letting us know that Francis Coppola just lost a fan. His new movie, of course, is Vice, a recording engineer. Thank you again. Here at NPR West is Marcia Caldwell. The show is mixed by Kat Yore. It's edited by Blake Fike, who's associate producer. I have no more quotes left to make. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.